Right, the title for the lecture this afternoon is Violence, Crisis or Catharsis? Crisis or Catharsis? And let me frame it again with some quotations from leading men who will appear in it. First, Frantz Fanon, the Algerian. Violence is a cleansing force. Secondly, Hitler. I cannot see why man should not be just as cruel as nature. Thirdly, Chairman Mao. Political power grows out of the barrel of a gun. Fourthly, a rather classic quotation heard on the radio in San Francisco, KGO Radio. Violence has no place in America. Anybody who preaches violence should be shot like a dog. Fifthly, a statement of Mailer's. There is a beastliness in the marrow of our century. And lastly, Arthur Koestler. Nature has let us down. God seems to have left the receiver off the hook, and time is running out. You can see that from the National Conference of the SNCC in 1966, right down through the recent bombings and incidents like the Weatherman bombings, it's clear that one of the defining features of the New Left has been its espousal of violence. And this has been justified both as necessary, pragmatically and philosophically. And this is certainly part of the newness of the New Left. Although we must admit, even when they throw bombs or even rocks, and we must admit, too, that they usually ask people to clear out of the buildings when they do so. This sort of violence is very different from the violence of radicals in other parts of the world, and it hardly equals the violence even of the early labor union struggles. So it's a different kind of violence on a low key, usually, but despite that, the New Left openly at certain points has advocated violence. This is interesting. The early Marx rejected violence and changed his mind only later on because he said it was inevitable in industrial societies, when any other means of revolution was impractical. Later on, Engels scorned nonviolence as what he called the parson's mode of thought. But the New Left, despite this, has been radical, anti-fascist, and at times, openly violent. So we really need to understand this violence on the level of the New Left itself, and also because it'll raise the question of violence in the larger areas of society. You remember the quotation from John Rader Platt the other day? The world has become too dangerous for anything less than utopia. And it's obvious in this situation that violence is one of the explosive issues which both delays the arrival of a humanist utopia and demands it. Unless we solve violence, there'll be no utopia, maybe no world at all. Surprisingly, very little, or comparatively little, has been written about violence until just recently. But in the last few years, a whole flood of studies have poured out. Presidential commissions, psychology department findings, philosophers theorizing, sociologists giving us statistics, a whole flood of new material. And you can see the violence also reflected very much in the general level of culture in books and in films. Either the content of films, and very certainly the style of films, the imagery, say, in Ken Russell's The Devil. Two films that would be useful to introduce the idea, one would be Weekend and the other would be If. You know, in Weekend, which is Jean-Luc Godard's film, he pictures society as a gigantic social slaughterhouse. And in the film If, Lindsay Anderson, the Scottish director, uses the picture of violence in an English boarding school as a metaphor of society in England generally. So let's look at this film in a bit of detail, because this film and its discussion of violence exactly raises the issue of violence as so many people in contemporary society see it. Because for many of them, the question is this: is violence to be understood as crisis, a breakdown of law and order, etc., or as catharsis, a rediscovery or cleansing of man? Now, in this film, you have two levels. On the one level, you have a strong caricature of a 19th century boarding school in England, a very authoritarian establishment. And as the boys, in their indiscipline, take to violence against the headmaster and so on, violence is clearly seen on the first level in terms of crisis. In other words, a breakdown of a school's law and order, authority, and discipline. But there's a deeper level in the film too. And on this deeper level, there are many subtler overtones which people who are intrigued by the story or outraged by the caricature miss. On this level, for instance, the boys, like Thoreau, come back from the end of their holidays having spent 3 weeks in the forest. The record player is always playing the music of the Congo Mass. And on the walls, they have a picture of the Simba rebels, the Congo uprising. And as they sit discussing over their philosophy and their worldview, a typical statement of this is the statement, "War and violence are the only pure acts left." Here, you see, the school order does not represent so much as authority and discipline, so much as repression. Since it's a system where they're taught to fight at the level of sports, and the sports is constantly, fight, boys, fight. Or in the army, or in the chapel, fight the good fight of faith, etc. So on this level, their violence, as they react against the repressive establishment, is justified, because it's not catharsis, it's not crisis, but catharsis. It's an assertion and rediscovery of their freedom. And it's interesting, the closing scenes of the film, the boys come out, and it's the liberal headmaster who comes out into the lawn and says, "Now, come on, boys, let's chat this through together, we can reason this one out." And a burst of machine gun fire, and he's lying dead, cut down by the first bullets. This is what you see in such a situation. Violence is crisis or catharsis. And it raises the question, which is violence, crisis or catharsis? Because very often, this is the polarization which many modern theorists, both those who oppose violence and those who advocate it, seem to suggest. Crisis or catharsis? Now, like all polarizations, we can see, actually, that this one is a very unsatisfactory formulation of the problem. And in the long run, this prevents secular man from finding a genuine solution. It's not that violence today is neither crisis nor catharsis, but actually it's both to both sides at once. But each sees it only as one and not the other. For instance, a closer study could demonstrate that even in those who suggest that violence is either crisis or catharsis, there is also a conscious or unconscious expression of the opposite pole. Take the radical. Many radicals strongly affirm violence as catharsis, cleansing of man. But in fact, if they think at all, it's only catharsis because of the intolerable nature of the present crisis. Or take the establishment man on the other side. Often the establishment speaker refers to violence as crisis, and in the name of this, he's able to repress dissent. Here's the crisis, and he puts it down. But in fact, often it's only their own violence which prevents them from seeing that as they put it down and call it crisis, the way they put it down is actually an affirmation of catharsis. For example, have you seen very often in our cultures, you have a subtle equation of violence and masculinity and patriotism. How are courage and manliness proved in America, classically? It's interesting that the Chicago police in 68... before they went to put down those goddamn hippies, as they said it, in other words, those whom they saw as representing the crisis of society, were making bets to see who could crack the most heads. In other words, psychologically for them, it acted as a catharsis, although publicly they justified it as crisis. So in fact, the elements of crisis and catharsis are psychologically inseparable, so that this polarization is finally fruitless. But it's worth examining, as this is the polarized alternatives that so many secular speakers give us. In the light of the present struggle for means of change, obviously the way we view violence is very crucial. Because as soon as you start to press for change, you soon see that you're resisted at many, many points, and then you're tempted to take to violence. And you've got to ask, what is the nature of violence, and is it permissible or not? Is it crisis or catharsis? Now let's go into the first section, though. And we'll look first at the emergence of the theory of violence. The emergence of the theory of violence. We'll understand this as a background to the whole thing. And we'll relate this particularly to the modern dilemma. Now, quite beyond the immediate interest of the details here these men were going to look into, grasp one point especially, and this is the crucial point. Common to all these various views of violence that I'm going to mention is the idea that in human society, violence has a certain normality. Normality, in a certain sense, it's necessary. And that's exactly the Achilles heel of these various views. Because as you'll see, in these theories, you begin by seeing violence in some sense as normal, and you very soon slide down to take it as necessary, and then it's very easy to other men to take it on to being legitimate. You see that? The quick slide from normalcy to necessity to legitimacy. And you've got to be very careful if you have such a view. Now, we'll look at four areas. And the first is violence in political theory. And this illustrating this premise that runs through them all. One place from which you can see the rise of modern science is from Rousseau's conception of the noble savage. Rousseau's basic dictum was that man was born free, but everywhere he's in chains. In other words, the noble savage was the primitive man in a childlike stage, who was unrepressed by culture or education or social conditioning. But now, unfortunately, because of culture, etc., freedom has been replaced by repression or restriction. And in such a context, where the original noble savage has been encrusted over by all these forms and traditions, violence has a liberating value because it restores the noble savage. Now, this has just been taken on, has been especially developed by the anarchists to justify their violence. The anarchists justify violence not just as pragmatically effective, i.e., it's good in overthrowing the particular tyrant, but even more as morally purifying. Because when you overthrow the tyranny, you get back down to the noble primitive savage, you really find the freedom. For instance, the Russian anarchist Bakunin, I'm not dealing with any of these men in exhaustively at all, in fact, very, very briefly. Bakunin said, the will to destroy is a creative will. So destruction is not just negative, it's positive because it creates too. Or the French anarchist Georges Sorel in his book Reflections on Violence in 1906. He said, it is to violence alone that socialism owes its high moral values and through which socialism brings salvation to the modern world. In other words, not just pragmatically effective, but morally liberating again. You could look at a lot more men, but the essential point is clear. Violence is considered normal wherever you have repressive political situations, and not just normal in certain circumstances, necessary and legitimate, i.e. it's a catharsis. Secondly, violence in the evolutionary theory. Look at this in a little more depth. Darwin's concept of natural selection, especially as it's interpreted by Huxley in terms of a free fight, appeared to justify the value of survival by means of violence. Life was viewed as a continuous free fight, and the most violent was clearly the most adapted to survival. We'll look at three examples of this expressed today in the modern behavioral theory, all explaining the emergence of violence as coming out of the animal nature. First, quickly, is Desmond Morris's book, The Naked Ape, only put in because it's read so widely. Morris, like the other three, or the other two, interprets violence as coming out of animal origins. For instance, he says the trouble is that whereas animals only want defeat or domination, i.e. aggression, man goes on to murder and violence. And he explains this and says the reason man is violent and the animals only aggressive is because of the rise of armed conflict. With unarmed conflict, there was no danger of violence, because aggression was conventionalized. For example, if one chimpanzee beats the other one ritually cowers, and the first one gives in, etc. And he says aggression was conventionalized, and even in human society it could have been if it was limited to things like judo, athletics, wrestling, and boxing. But armed conflict has created the horror of violence by making two vital extensions which have turned aggression into violence. The first extension is that of the hands. In other words, the hand was developed through technology into the club, the spear, the gun, the bomb, the missile. So the hand developed this greatly explosive potential power, and this has led from aggression to violence. The second extension is not the hand, but the space between the two fighters. So when you fight with a fist, you have to be close enough for human contact. When you fight with a club, you're further away, with a spear at throwing distance. With a bow and arrow, you can see the other man. With a rifle, he's just a dot on the horizon. But with the bomb, he's just an impersonal there. You don't even see him when you press the button. So in the light of this, Morris says man has developed violence because of the extension of these two things, the power of the fist and the gap between the fighters, and the result is modern destructive violence. I quote, we are, to put it mildly, in a mess. And there's a strong chance that we shall have exterminated ourselves by the end of the century. Again, another of the men is saying that this may be the end of the human race. But then he finishes, our only consolation will have to be that as a species, we've had an exciting term of office. A typically facile, glib statement which you find in Morris a tremendous amount. And I put it in simply because it's so widely read. But you see what he's saying? It's normal in man and necessary because of the development of man's nature. The second example of this, and much more serious, is that of Conrad Lorenz, his book On Aggression. As a humanist and a scientist, Lorenz rejects both morals and metaphysics as any way of understanding violence. He said the only way we can understand violence is to see the way it's risen out of the animal nature. And Lorenz progresses from the animal world, incidentally he calls that what I know, i.e. that which is scientifically verifiable, to the human world, which he says is that which is probable, i.e. that which is he's extending from the animal world, to his own solutions, which he calls what I believe. In other words, that which he neither has scientific verification for, nor even possible extensions, but merely his own faith. Now, in the animal world, he says, violence is only aggression, and it has several valuable functions. For example, the selection of the strongest by rival fights, the defense of the young, etc., etc. So in the animal world, aggression is not destructive, but it's life-preserving. But the problem, again, is that man has developed violence in a dangerous way. Well, why is it? This is Lorenz's reason. Man has all the aggressive instincts, but not the same inhibitions. Two key words there, instincts, but not inhibitions. In other words, the progress of man's culture has outpaced the progress of his social inhibitions. So man, with his higher reason, love, and morality, is unable to control his lower nature. So Conrad Lorenz, I quote, says, "All the great dangers threatening humanity with extinction are the direct consequences of thought and verbal speech." So his solution is to control human behavior and this way to remove violence. And you see his solution comes to a climax in his last chapter, which is called An Avowal of Optimism. But what I want you to notice is that it's his basis for optimism that's fascinating. I'll quote, this is the last page. "The obvious conclusion is," now you see his argument so far, "animals have no problem, are merely aggressive. Man, though, has got the instincts, but not the inhibitions, because his reason, love, morality, which makes him higher, is in fact weaker than the animal's inhibitions. So violence is destructive." Here's his conclusion. "The obvious conclusion is that love and friendship should embrace all humanity, and that we should love all our human brothers. Our reason is quite able to understand this necessity, as our feeling is able to appreciate the beauty of this. But nevertheless, made as we are unable to obey it." Sorry, I missed out a line. "This commandment is not new, and made as we are unable to obey it. And the utmost exertion of willpower cannot alter this fact." So here's his argument to here, but here's the closing paragraph of the book. "But the great constructors can, and I believe they will. For I believe in the power of human reason, as I believe in the power of natural selection." Now, if you're thinking, the immensity of what he's done is breathtaking. He spent almost all the book, in the first half of this very paragraph, emphasizing the dilemma of man as being the result of the evolutionary crisis. In other words, because of the evolutionary process, man hasn't enough inhibitions because his reason, love, and morality are great, but too weak. So then he gives you the grounds for his optimism. "I believe in what? The great constructors, i.e. evolution personified, and human reason, which he just told you is too weak." And the book finishes with an avowal of optimism. A good example of the humanist, very fast, fancy footwork in the final seconds. So he ends up denying a lot the tenancy of much of his evidence and ends up with optimism. A third man now, and Morris is the sort of popularized one. Lorenz is the optimistic one, and here's a pessimistic version of the same area. This is Arthur Koestler's The Ghost and the Machine. Koestler, too, says that man's problem with violence is that he's on an evolutionary crisis. And I quote, "It appears highly probable that Homo sapiens is a biological freak, the result of some remarkable mistake in the evolutionary process." This is Koestler's idea. Man suffering from a pathological condition because there's a lack of integration between two brains. The lower brain is the old animal brain, the archicortex, and the higher brain, the neocortex, is the new rational brain. And these two are out of joint. They're not integrated. And so man is violent because of this. I quote, "It is entirely unprecedented that evolution should provide a species with an organ which it does not know how to use." The remark I made the other day. Now this leads Koestler to complete pessimism. And if you read the last third of Koestler's book, he's really remarkably like an Old Testament prophet of doom. His only answer in the closing stages is that we might solve the problem by finding a pill, which if we put it in the water systems, will join the lower and the upper brains, and this will be the answer. But his closing words are the ones I began with. Nature has let us down. God seems to have left the receiver off the hook, and time is running out. Now you see in all these three, all in behavioral science coming from the evolutionary theory, an extraordinary paradox. The very feature which distinguishes man as being higher than the animals damns him as being higher. For Lorenz, it's culture, for Kirstel, the upper brain. So the very thing which distinguishes a man becomes the thing which damns him, which is not a very high view of man. But you see, in all of them, again, you have the idea that in human society as it is, violence is normal in a certain sense because of its animal origins and the development of man's culture. That's all I'm just stressing. Third area is violence in the psychoanalytic theory. The psychoanalytic theory. The key to psychoanalysis is the idea of repression. In other words, psychoanalysis deals with a conflict resulting with a clash between the so-called pleasure principle and the reality principle. Freud said the repression is the whole pillar on which psychoanalysis rests. And man is born into a world where there's this dualistic fight, so he's always struggling for pleasure and life and love against reality and death. And Freud said that no adult life was free from this conflict and repression, the dualistic tension between the basic instincts of eros, love, and thanatos, death. And because of this constant dualism like this, violence is rooted in man's nature. In other words, Freud was very realistic about violence. It wasn't caused by the environment, nor by man's ignorance, nor by his poor education. It was much more radical, nothing to do with mere external things, although they might aggravate it, such as slum conditions. For instance, Freud bluntly dismissed communism as far too shallow in his diagnosis. He said aggression, for instance, was never prompted just by the desire for property. But rather, Freud says, aggression forms the basis of every relation. Why? Because of man's nature. Freud said elsewhere, wherever civilization may develop, one thing we can expect, and this is that indestructible feature of human nature, violence will follow it there. Now, this is a very, very realistic view of violence. You see certain things in this. Expounding Freud, Norman O'Brown pins this down in three places in which you can understand violence. I'll give you three quotations. First, Brown says, Freud's fundamental perspective is that the evil in man is not to be explained away as a superficial excrescence on a basically good human nature, but is rooted in a deep conflict in human nature itself. So in other words, while external factors and circumstantial factors may be aggravating, they're never the root cause of violence. Secondly, Brown says, this means that Freud has so formulated the conflict between eros and the aggressive instinct as to preclude or shut out the possibility of salvation or cure. With an innate tendency to aggression, mankind's only alternative is to turn it outwards and destroy others, or turn it inwards and destroy himself. And then the third point he makes is, it still remains true, if this aggressiveness is innate and accumulates, then psychoanalysis may hope for a rebirth of eros, but rationally it can only predict the self-destruction of the human race. So you get his three points. One, violence is rooted in human nature itself and not in anything external. Two, this means it can only go one of two ways, either lash out externally or boomerang back and be taken out on itself internally, psychologically, for instance. Three, this means that you can hope for the rebirth of eros, love, solution, peace, but rationally, you can only see the destruction of the entire human race. You know that Freud ended his life extremely pessimistically. It should be obvious that if this is so, violence is inextricably rooted in the human nature. But at the same time, because of this dualism, it's inevitable as an outburst of this subterranean conflict which Freud sees. So violence, on the one hand, is normal, because all men are like this. And on the other hand, it's necessary, too, because you've got to get the steam's got to blow off the kettle every so often. So violence releases the instincts temporally, which are repressed, but it never finally resolves the dualism, because you never escape this total conflict. Now, this is theory. But this particular one is very widely echoed in modern sociology and politics. For example, Paul Goodman, the sociologist, has a background in psychoanalysis. And he has theories that he feels, for instance, that violence, like face-to-face violence, like a fist fight, is natural. It's just man getting off rid of the steam, so it's better to have the fight out, etc., etc. And you hear many, many people like this justifying certain types of violence, and the background of this is their belief in the theories of psychoanalysis. Another example of this, justifying involuntary violence, i.e. the kettle blowing off, it would be a good statement from Malcolm X at one stage. Malcolm X says, I'm non-violent with those who are non-violent with me. But when you drop that violence on me, i.e. repression, then you've made me go insane and I'm not responsible for what I do. I.e. the kettle blows off and you ask for it because you build up the steam too high. You can see this in many places. We'll look at another man later, Franz Fanon, very strong in the same thing. But once again, the normalcy, and in certain situations, the necessity of violence. The last area we'll look at is very briefly, violence in cultural theory. Cultural theory. Here you unearth the old idea that violence is a symptom of an individual or a total society under stress. So it could be a slum boy pressed back against the wall of the ghetto, or a nation threatened economically for its life. Either of them, when they're really pressed back under stress, lash out. And this leads to violence. And many people explain violence like this. Perhaps the most modern expression of this is, in an original way, is McLuhan's idea. McLuhan's idea is that wherever cultures, when one culture dies and a new culture comes in, you've got a gap between the two. And this gap between the two is what he calls the cultural blues, or the kaleidoscope, not the kaleidoscope, but the kaleidoscope, one of his little puns. When one culture goes out, another comes in, and you have a kaleidoscope between, one mark of it always is violence. And violence is used in this situation as a search for identity. So the people stake themselves out. This comes very strongly in his book, War and Peace in the Rural Village. For instance, in our situation, he would say, the printing press age is going out, the electric era, in other words, the Gutenberg galaxy, the electric era, the television's coming in, two generations are caught between the two. The older generation and the younger generation, both without roots, because they're between. Both have no identity. But the older generation, to find an identity, looks back, nostalgia. The younger generation has no roots in the past, so it lashes out in violence, and this is how I explain student power, etc. I'll quote. When anyone's been hurt by new technology, either the private person or the corporate body, finding its entire identity endangered by psychic or psychical change, it lashes back in a fury of self-defense. Thus, violence is an involuntary quest for identity. This is how he would explain, for instance, a book like Eldridge Cleaver's Soul and Ice. You remember Cleaver's great statement, we shall have our manhood. We shall have it or the earth will be leveled by our attempts to gain it. So in this situation, caught between the two cultures, violence is normal and necessary as a search for identity. Now, all these analyses and many others are important for various reasons, but I've only used them here to show you the variations on the one essential theme, the understanding of violence in a certain sense as normal. Now, see that and appreciate that in the light of our present context in a post-Christian culture. In other words, in a culture where you have moral relativism anyway, or as Toffler says, we're suffering from a value vertigo. There are no absolutes, and there are no values or ethical ideals. Here's the danger now, you see the crux of it. Without a moral framework, normalcy slides to necessity and necessity towards legitimacy, and there's nothing to stop you. Without a moral reference point, violence will become increasingly prevalent because all we have left is a power struggle, the will to power, in the vacuum created by relativism. And really, make no mistake, we are in a classical age of violence for this reason. This is the lesson of our times. With these views of violence and human nature, without a moral framework by which to judge them or limit them, violence is absolutely inevitable in every strata of our society. And we need to expect this and understand it and be ready for it. Camus warned like this, men of action, when they are without faith, i.e. principles, have never believed in anything else but action. Well, Cyril Wright Mills put it like this, all politics is a struggle for power. But the ultimate kind of power is violence. Now you see why Hitler's comment is so devastating. I cannot see why man should not be just as cruel as nature. In other words, if you tell me that man is the same as the animal and so on, and there's no God and no values, and nature evolves through the survival of the fittest, Why should man not be just the same way as nature? Can you fault him on his logic? Not without a Christian basis. Now you see the importance, too, of Chairman Mao. Political power grows out of the barrel of the gun. In other words, and we really need to appreciate this, right no longer gives might. Rather, might makes right. Law now is what a man can get away with. And lawlessness is what he will not allow the other man to get away with. But neither now defined by objective absolutes. Or as Wendell Holmes said, truth becomes the majority law of that nation which can pose its view or values on all others. We really need to feel this from whichever angle the sting comes home. You remember the Austrian statesman Clausewitz defined war as war is the continuation of politics by other means. Today, the modern dilemma is far more excruciating. Violence is now not just externalized, it's internalized. Hannah Arendt, she says, peace is the continuation of war by other means. We really need to feel the sting of this. With the death of the absolutes, the prospects are grim for anyone who loves justice, freedom, and order. And you can be sure that unless there's a reformation and a revival and return to real morals and standards, Western culture is going to lurch drunkenly between a chaotic lawlessness and an accounting authoritarianism, which could well, in some day of an abysmal vacuum of confidence, issue in a supreme dictatorship. And as we do this, incidentally, violence is certainly going to be one of the blood brothers of totalitarianism. We're going to see a power struggle on every level. Now, in this such a day as this, and one of the other byproducts of the death of the absolutes, has been a failure to hold any balanced middle ground. The polarity between violence seen as crisis and as necessary catharsis is typical of this. In other words, without the absolutes, without the middle ground, you either have the middle ground, which is the silent majority without a base, or people who think and care spin out to the polarized extremes, and this forms this idea of crisis or catharsis. So let's go on to the second main section now. The emergence of violence as a theory, and you can see the dilemma. If it's normal, in our climate, the danger arises. But now we'll go to the second section. We'll look at two expressions of these extremes. First, a radical, and second, a liberal. The radical demands violence because it's catharsis. The liberal decries violence because it's crisis. So you can see that the extremity of the polarization is pointed up in the comparative unpopularity of nonviolence, which has slipped in status from the high respect that it had just 10 or 15 years ago. That's why we were saying the other day, as someone was pointing out, two great heroes of nonviolence, Gandhi and Martin Luther King, are being explained away today in times that would have been inconceivable a little while ago. For example, many people are saying Gandhi had other factors going for him. You know, if the Indians had lain down in front of the Russian tanks, the tanks would have gone straight over them. It was some sort of lingering credit to the rather feeble morality that was still there at the end of the British Empire that the non-violence of Gandhi was successful, but it wouldn't have been in front of a totalitarian power. Others are beginning to whisper that maybe Martin Luther King died just in time. In other words, he died just before the time when people, and the blacks especially, changed from non-violence to the espousal of violence as a much quicker way to get things done. The second critique of Luther King is a little unfair, but it's definitely part of the present climate. You can see that this non-violent position is hard to hold in a day like ours, and you spin off pretty easily to the two extremes. Let's first then look at one example, violence as catharsis. In other words, a radical who demands violence because it's cathartic. Here, the best example is Franz Fanon, a very important man in the history of modern radicalism. And the book here that's crucial is his book, The Wretched of the Earth. The Wretched of the Earth. Fanon was born in Martinique in 1925 and died of leukemia in New York in 1961, only 36 years old. He studied both medicine and psychiatry. But before his death, he was important for being one of the leading spokesmen for the Algerian Revolution and above all for the Third World. And he was one of those who put the Third World on the map. He was always proud to call himself the champion of the poorest men on earth. But basic to his vision of the Third World was his warning that the Third World must never become another Europe. He said Europe, you see, had ostensibly been humanist, but had denied this by its inhumanity. I quote, "For centuries, Europe has stifled almost the whole of humanity in the name of a so-called spiritual experience. She has only shown herself niggardly where men are concerned." That incident was the first Europe. What he calls the second Europe was North America, which he describes as that super-European monstrosity. Now, it's out of this hatred of Europe and this call for the third world that Fanon at the same time calls for violence. Because he says violence is the only answer to colonialism. Because violence is literally the reaction to the action of colonialism. Because the colonialism, in his definition, is violence just in three stages. This is how his idea goes. The first stage of violence in colonialism is oppression. Whether it's the British going to India, or the French going to Algeria, or the Americans with their economic policy, you come in from outside and you dominate and you oppress. That's the first stage, oppression. The second stage is repression. When the indigenous natives of a particular country are oppressed, they can no longer clash back, they're too weak. They're policed and kept down. So what do? They take it out on themselves. And you have a period of chronic tribalism, magic, and fratricidal murders and infighting. And this is typical of many of the colonial countries. The third stage, however, is revolution. In other words, violence comes from outside oppression. The people at this stage can't take it back on their oppressors. They take it out on themselves and each other, and they degrade themselves. But finally, the balance of power changes, and you get violence third is the moment of the boomerang lashes back. Fanon writes, "He of whom they have never stopped saying, the only language he understands is that of force, suddenly decides to give utterance by force." So here's his analysis of colonialism. But this is his main point. Violence is not just pragmatically indispensable. Violence is rehumanizing, because these natives who've been dehumanized by oppression, as they take to violence, discover themselves as new men. It's catharsis. And his book is just punctuated with quotes that reiterate this in a thousand ways. I'll read a few. "The colonized man finds his freedom in and through violence. This violence invests their characters with positive and creative values. Violence is a cleansing force. It frees the native from his inferiority complex and from his despair and inaction. It makes him fearless and restores his self-respect." Those are several pages run together, quotations from several pages. This is his great dream. He speaks of the workless of the world, the prostitutes, the hopeless dregs of humanity, being reawakened and rediscovering themselves as they take to violence and bloodshed, and so marching proudly in the great procession of liberated nations, the Third World. The preface of the book is by Sartre, and you get the same idea there. For example, he says now, writing of the revolutionary, "This irrepressible violence is neither sound nor fury, nor the resurrection of savage instincts, nor even the effect of resentment. It is man recreating himself." Or again, "When his rage boils over, he recovers his lost innocence," echoes of Rousseau, "and comes to know himself in that he himself creates his self." Or again, "To shoot down a European is to kill two birds with one stone. To destroy an oppressor and be a man he oppresses at the same time, i.e., because he's no longer oppressed, he's come alive." Or again, writing of the colonial powers, his fellow Frenchman, he says, "We have sown the wind, he is the whirlwind. The child of violence, at every moment he draws it from his humanity. We were men at his expense. He makes himself man at ours, a different man, of higher quality." Get the idea? You take to violence, and violence is catharsis in this situation. And you can hear echoes of this in many, many places. Marcuse, Eldridge Cleaver, Stokely Carmichael, R.D. Lang. They're all clearly saying, in a situation of repression, violence not only throws off the oppressor, it invests the revolutionary with new hope, new ideals, and a new humanity, i.e. it's cathartic. Incidentally, you could say a lot of things about Fanon to knock it down. I'll just mention one. It's interesting that in The Wretched of the Earth, Fanon the propagandist, i.e. all just described, is totally contradicted by Fanon the psychiatrist. This is the interesting thing. In the same book, he has both propaganda and psychiatric studies of people he treated as a psychiatrist. And his case histories include studies of many of the rebels who are perpetrators of violence, who later on suffered from acute anxiety, insomnia, suicidal obsessions, and other psychological problems. In other words, he includes dramatically good evidence in the very book that far from freeing them and making new men, it turned many of them into psychological cases who never recovered. So there's absolute contradiction between the propaganda and the case studies. But still, it's a very important book. Secondly, the other idea, and I shouldn't need to go into this because we have it expressed so often, the idea of violence as crisis. Here I'll cite Arthur Schlesinger Jr.'s book, Violence, America in the 60s. And perhaps this is vital not only for what it says, but for what it shows of a kind of troubled conscience and disquiet of a liberal. You remember it was written in 1968, following the assassination of the Kennedys, who were Schlesinger's close friends. Here, I won't give you his argument, but just a quick running survey of his chapters that tells the stories. First chapter is called A Sick Society? And he quotes a whole plethora of people going through LBJ, Lord Harlech, the London Times, Yevtushenko, Brezhnev. And he suggests that because of American violence, the world will describe that they are the most frightening people on this planet. So after his initial statement, he plunges back into American history and shows the common theme running through the whole of American history, a resort to violence as the American way of life. Shows that from the treatment of the Indians down to the enslaving of the blacks, right down to the current assassinations, violence is a recurrent theme at every stage, and only at one period was it absent. The 50-year period after the Civil War. He says, strangely enough, this 50-year period created the image of normal America, when actually the normal America is, you know, Rap Brown's famous statement, violence is American as cherry pie. He goes into all sorts of other facts and details which I won't mention. I'll mention just a couple. For instance, a little point, he says that America, with a population of only 200 million, has 6,500 gun murders. Whereas other industrial nations, such as Great Britain, Japan, West Germany, and several others combined, with a population of the same, have only about 135 gun murders a year. Most extraordinarily disparate number. He goes into what he calls televiolence. Then if you knew, for instance, the average American watches television nearly 9 years of his life in toto. And on television, he sees on average violence every 15 minutes and a murder every 45 minutes. Now, I won't go into his whole argument, but the book is hardly up to his normal standards. But the point is, it's representative of an attitude which you can see from the liberal left to conservative right, including much of the silent majority. And to many people like this, violence is seen as a crisis which tears at the heart of society and tends to destroy all that for which they're standing for and fighting for. Writing, this is the context of Mailer's comment after the Chicago Convention in 1968. He said, America can be described as roaring like a bull in its wounds, as he looked at the violence. And he ended with this gloomy prediction. There is a beastliness in the marrow of a century. We will all be fighting for the next 40 years. So there you are, violence as crisis. And you can see it expressed by many people, the casual reactions. They open the paper and see an incident and whatever they say at the breakfast table. They see it as crisis tearing away at the fabric of everything for which they see society stands for. Now, we could look at other theorists, strategists, or analysts of violence. You could analyze all sorts of incidents of violence in our own time, but you see the same polarization so often expressed. On the one side, violence is crisis, breaking down the order and values, and on the other hand, violence is catharsis, recreating people. So a conclusion on this first part, which is a survey, really, of the secular scene today. I don't think that any evaluation of the present position can be seen in terms other than what we call in the first lecture the striptease of humanism. In other words, one more tightening of a screw towards dehumanization. And obviously, if you just think through what we've looked into, the sting of the modern views of violence is felt at two places. They're both very obvious. First, violence, whether it's open or masked, is socially destructive. Violence today can rarely achieve its promised change. And usually, whatever the theory, the effect is roughly the same. Maybe the Viet Cong massacres, or the Kent State shootings, or the Kennedy assassinations, or the bombing of the grenades and things, that ghastly massacre at Lidder Airport last week, or the Wisconsin Math Center, etc., etc. The result's always the same. It's men who are being killed, and homes that are being destroyed, and society that's being disrupted. Again, you can say reason and morality are faltering. Power has become a principle, and might equals right. And the only prospect for humanity in this situation is havoc and hurt. And let's really understand this. This is our time. But secondly, you can see something else. Such violence is also a focal point of alienation for those who are really sensitive. Think back now to the view of man that came to light in those various theories. The very thing which distinguished man from the animals and machines becomes a thing which damns him. Now, the examples of Kersal and Wren's are far from unique. And again, they point to modern man's low view of himself, distinguished from the animals, more than animal, but damned as being less than God. Distinguished but damned, a fateful modern tribute to man. Or again, what substantial hope do you have if, like Freud, you can hope all you like for love, but all you can rationally predict is destruction? And that's why for many people, just the consideration of violence, you can see it's one of the focal points of a sense of alienation. It's one aspect of the present system that's preventing the realization of humanness. In other words, if you realize that you can only have a utopia by overcoming such violence, how do you overcome the violence? Through change. But to do change, you need violence, and so violence stops the achievement of such a thing. And now you're at the point, though, when there's no guarantee that the violence against any system would be that which would not be too strong for the system, and the system might not even survive. And the use of violence, particularly in the nuclear age, really becomes like a game of Russian roulette, with the stakes mounting higher and higher. Now let's turn, though, from that and look at Christianity and violence. Christianity and violence. And this first section I'd like to do is a summary of traditional views. We'll look back over some of the history of the church and some of the traditional views just to get a perspective on these. The first general view, often the majority view, has been the belief in the justification of force. The belief that force is justified. Now, this view is based on such things as Paul's argument in the letter to Romans, where he asserts that the state has a certain God-given validity. And from this, people make a decisive distinction between force and violence. For example, people like this have supported just warfare. Now, you can see representations of this view in many, many of theologians of different varieties down through the centuries. And such giants as the following all supported this in one degree or another. Augustine, Aquinas, Calvin, Karl Barth, right down spanning the centuries and spanning different views, Protestant and Catholic, etc. They all supported this. Most in this camp would hold a just war theory, and they would say that anything in the nature of a coup d'etat or rebellion or revolution is wrong, because it's revolt against a divinely ordained state and is therefore violence. That's the general premise. Now, you can have a wide variety of differences under this, and this is important, a wide variety of interpretations. For example, on the one hand, there'd be those who would only obey the state when and if the state is not opposed to the higher law of God. And if the state was against God, you obey God rather than the state. On the other hand, the extreme, you have those like the German Christians at the beginning of the last war, a whole section of whom, the Deutsche Christen, remained silent regarding Hitler, because they tended to obey the state rather blindly. So there's the first position, the justification of force, with the idea of the God-given validity to the state. The second position, also widely held, but not quite so widely held, is that of non-violence, not justifying force. Many claim that very probably this was the general position up until the 4th century AD. Interestingly, no text before the 2nd century shows any Christians in the army. And I think the first text to do so is a treatise of Tertullian, the North African lawyer, who condemns army involvement by Christians and explains that it was happening only because the Christians were under duress to be soldiers. Interestingly, too, many of the early martyrs were those who either abstained from going into the army or resigned from the army on conversion because of their Christian principles. In the 3rd century, there was a man called Maximilian who said, "I cannot be a soldier. I cannot do evil. I am a Christian." But gradually, this was relaxed. The first qualification in the relaxing was when Christians were allowed to be part of a peacekeeping force, which is called militari in Latin, but not part of a fighting army, which is called bellari in Latin. There was the first relaxation. But the watershed of the changes came with the so-called ostensible conversion of Constantine, because this was when the Roman Empire became ostensibly Christian. Later on, war was justified at the Council of Arles in 314, And since then, non-violence, generally speaking, has not been the majority view. Now, of course, it's emerged again and again, for instance, with Francis of Assisi or the Waldensians, and it's been vogue in certain periods, like in our own century, just after World War I, with a tremendous reaction to the monstrous waste of human life in that war. The third group are those who have justified violence on Christian principles. And I would stress that this has very much been the majority view right down through the centuries. What examples do we have in history of this? Well, typical of this are the 3rd century Nile anchorites. They were people who lived in caves above Alexandria in Egypt and came roaring down on Alexandria several times, beating and clubbing the citizens in an attempt to purify the city, just as Christ had purified the temple, and really took upon themselves the role of being human instruments of divine judgment and were extremely brutal. Now, that was very, very, very rare in the early church. I stress that. It's totally a minority view and a freak view, and you can see biblically a non-Christian view. But the same attitude in variations appeared like a rash in the Middle Ages. With the disintegrating social conditions and the injustice on every hand, you had many, many revolutions justified in the name of Christianity. And actually, modern revolution, both anarchist and otherwise, has its roots in the Christian revolutions in the medieval times. The rising of Father Dolcino in 1507, the peasant revolt under Thomas Munzer, the siege of Munster in 1535 by John of Leyden. All of these were illustrations of this. You can find illustrations, incidentally, also in the group, the Dutchmen who attacked the Spanish control in the Low Countries, in the Puritans, the Levellers, who overthrew the power of the king and killed Charles I, and so on and so on and so on. But it's important, this view particularly, because it's in our own time that this view has really flowered most fully, especially among the extremes of liberal Protestantism and progressive Roman Catholicism. A Roman Catholic priest has said, "God is not the dominator, but the awakener of guerrillas among oppressed peoples." A Black Power pastor in Detroit says that violence is redemptive, and he believes in the saving power of violence. And many of the liberal theologians on the Protestant side and the progressive theologians on the Catholic side have this idea that God is seen today, not in the scriptures, etc., but in the zones of revolution. In the dim line where you see the zone of revolution, there God is at work, and so violence is justified in the name of God. They say that in the essence of revolution do we witness the eruption of God's sovereignty. In other words, they really exchange the crisis of new birth for the crisis of revolution. But I'd really stress that this is very much a minority view. The best man for going to critique of some of these is Jacques Ellul's book on violence. He gives a very clear survey of these three positions, especially the last one. And he makes two comments on them both, which are very, very important to understand. The first comment is this. You see these three positions and the way the church has gone back and forwards between the three over the centuries. Ellul makes two very good comments. First of all, often the differences between the people in them are more temperamental than theological. Very, very important point. In other words, the first position, justification of force, tends to appeal by motivation to the man who is conformist, institutional, reasonable, somewhat moderate in his character. The trouble is he joins this not because it's Christian and right, but because he's naturally suited to that particular variety. Similarly, the second position tends to appeal to the man who sees himself, otherwise the non-violent pacifist man, sees himself as the sufferer in the heroic mold, sacrificial, etc. He doesn't do this because it's right, always, but partly because his motivation is that this fits in with his character. And the third position tends to appeal to the man, i.e. justifying violence, who is apocalyptic, immoderate, simplistic. Then what happens, you see, they choose this view because of temperament, not theology. Then they back it up by theology, which tends to be simplistic, with the whole use of the Bible, not in its unity, but in terms of proof texts. In other words, not as a basis, but just as proof texts, very selectively. That's his first point. It's a very good one. We must not choose between these three in terms of temperament because of theology. You see, in any situations, whether it's pessimism, optimism, or whatever, usually there's more things than one for us to choose. There's usually evidence as to which is right, plus temperament and motivation and character, etc. And we need to be very careful why we're doing what we're doing, even if it's the right thing. Second comment he makes, this is interesting too. He says, when changes are made between the two views, or three views, all too often, they are not made according to Christian principles, but made according to the spirit of the times. Very, very important too for our generation, which flows back in a kind of consensus polls of opinions. Because of this, any changes, they lack specific Christian witness. For example, the 19th century was mainly nationalistic. So it's very normal for the bishops to bless the bombers as they went out to bomb, and the cannons, etc. On the other hand, the 20th century is getting increasingly revolutionary. Today's with it, bishops bless the guerrillas. This is what I meant about the German Christians. In 1933, Hitler accused them of being weak, beggarly, and effeminate. I.e., he threw at them everything that Nietzsche threw at them. So what happened? The German Christians said that they would be courageous and espouse a courage and virility. And then they found themselves following Hitler to the point that they were completely compromised. They just fell in line with the spirit of their times. And this is what Elul is charging is happening today. For example, since 1950, the World Council of Churches and Liberalism has more and more espoused the cause of the poor. But Elul shows that they've espoused the poor in direct ratio to the fact that they've downbased any true theology of God. They're almost in danger of deifying the poor in the place of God. A French priest was asked if he believed Christ was God. He said, yes, but only because he's the poorest of men. In other words, he's not God because he's God become man, but he's God because he's the symbol of the purest of men, poorest of men. And so around him, we have a symbol which we can have a revolutionary banner. Very dangerous thing. Let me add a third comment to Elul's other two. That's this. Just as a balanced non-violence is held to be historically passé in the secular world, so sadly this is very true of much of contemporary Christianity. You can see a lot of Christians in a violent situation or reading about violence react emotionally. And when they do so, they just reflect these same two polarizations, crisis or catharsis, rather than specific Christian principles. So here's a broad survey of the past, just to give us a perspective. And now we'll go on to Christianity and violence, a closer look at some of the Christian answer to this. But we'll have a couple of minutes break first. I think I made it, someone pointed out, I may have made a mistake. In that first view, I should have said it was the justification of force. And in the third view, I should have said and made it clear that is a minority view, not a majority view. The first one was the justification of force, that's the majority view. Second was non-violence, or pacifism very often. And the third was the justification of violence, which is very much a minority view, just to make that clear. Let's go on then to a section which I call Christianity and Violence. And here we'll see the crux of the whole problem is to try to understand the Christian nature, the Christian view of the nature of violence. And I think what we'll see here is that it's exactly here that Christianity is both most radical and most realistic. We must begin by diagnosing the character and the inexorable logic of violence. And what we'll do is look at biblical teaching and human history seen in the light of the biblical principles. In the light of this, I'd like to point out five facets, five features, five aspects of the biblical nature of violence, or the nature of violence as seen biblically. And as we see these five, we'll see in the light of this what the Christian response should be. First of all, the identity of violence. Now, the first recorded murder in the Bible is the murder of Abel by his brother Cain. But if you look at this in Genesis 4, you can't understand this except by comparing it with the preceding story in Genesis 3, the story of the fall. When man chooses to stand against God and set himself up as his own integration point, he doesn't just violate the vertical relationship between himself and God. That wasn't the end. After the vertical relationship is disrupted, the horizontal relationship is inevitably also disrupted between man, and man and nature, etc. So Cain's violation of Abel's life was only the outflowing of what was already incipient in the fall. You can see if you compare Genesis 3 and 4 and 11, you can see that they clearly teach, I think it's chapter 9 actually, sorry, Genesis 3, chapter 4 and 9, which is the story of the institution of capital punishment, they clearly teach that what is violence, what violence is nothing else than the violation of who a man is before God. And this is really the heart of the concept of violation. Violence is the violation of who a man is before God. In other words, every man is finite, like all God's creation. But he has a distinctive difference in that man alone is made in the image of God. And because he is made in the image of God, man is inviolable. It's in Genesis 9. Now, this inviolability is fundamental. Violence, therefore, is seen in terms of all that which violates man as he is before God and as he is in himself. At the lowest level, this inviolability includes man's essential property, his belongings, his clothes, his food. And you can do violence on that level. More important still, it includes his territory, the sphere of his work, the sphere of his leisure, his home. Every man genuinely needs something of personal space. More crucially still, it includes his personality, a man's reputation, his image, his security, his drives, his aspirations, his character. And of course, supremely, it includes his life. And this would be the Christian understanding of violence, that which violates who a man is, not defined by any sociological or merely human terms, but before God. Now, this understanding of man's inviolability makes the Bible the most radical of all views of violence. And it's this which Jesus sharpens still further. Because in Matthew 5, Jesus refuses to make any distinction between the external assault, which was the physical harm, and the internal attitude, i.e. the motivation. In other words, he makes no distinction in a certain point between murder and the motive which can lead to it. The assault that takes place is only the anger spelt out in action. Remember, Jesus said, "You have learned that our forefathers were told, 'Do not commit murder.' Anyone who commits murder must be brought to judgment. But what I tell you is this, anyone who nurses anger against his brother must be brought to judgment." In other words, the guilt of violence is back in the area of the psychology and the motivation, and not just in the area of the external act. This means that for Christians, we must take a definition of violence that's far stronger than merely physical wounding or killing. And violence can be anything between that supreme act of killing and anything right back to the internal motivation. It can be physical, economic, psychological, whether it's applied with a velvet glove or an iron fist. In other words, it's spelled out in terms of anything that violates another man's humanness before God. Obviously, in a sense, it can come from all sides and at all levels. And it's not just external things, say the Viet Cong or the GIs. It can come equally from a very respectable president or equally from a very respectable parent. Any refusal to see this becomes a mystification over again, a masking of the fact that we are all prone to this. As R.D. Lang says with his ideas, "We are all murderers and prostitutes, no matter to what culture, society, class, and nature one belongs, no matter how normal, moral, or mature one takes oneself to be." That's R.D. Lang's idea, and Christ was saying the same thing, but in a far more profound situation. Any man who knows the nature of his own heart, and the Christian should, immediately realize that violence is never the other man's problem, it is all our problem, and it is supremely my problem. And wherever we see violence, the Christian knows that there but for the grace of God go I. But unlike R.D. Lang, this does not lead to demystification and then a new violence, a counter-violence. Any demystification, i.e. understanding we're all prone to it, must lead to penitence. Incidentally, this first feature of violence means that its justification is never legitimate and its calculus is never possible, because one human life seen before God is priceless. The identity of violence, that's the first point. Man made in the image of God is inviolable. Violence is the violation of all that which man is before God in the whole range of his humanness.